is Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. Growing up in Kakuma's refugee camp, Niall Deng says that he always dreamt of pursuing a career in journalism. He used his passion for storytelling to start initiatives in the refugee camp, like the Refugee Youth Peace Ambassadors, and She Leads Kakuma, empowering over 20,000 young people through education, peace building, and entrepreneurship. Now pursuing his bachelor's degree in Canada, Neil tells me that he continues to advocate for refugee issues, gender equality, education, and is currently developing the Kakuma Leadership and Innovation Center to support youth in the camp. He joins me in studio.
My name is Niall Deng. I'm original from South Sudan, a country that has been devastated by conflict for a very long time. And, like many South Sudanese family, my family was displaced by the conflict. So I was born in Ethiopia, and then I grew up in Kakuma refugee camp, which is where I started my community leadership work, using education, sports, entrepreneurship, and peace building to help young people in the refugee camp build a better future. Mm. And on the other hand, as well, engaging with different institutions at the global level to create awareness about challenges facing refugees, not just in Africa, but across the world.
Right. What inspired you to start your change maker journey? I think this, you say, was in 2017. And what was the catalyst for your work in the Kakuma refugee camp? Most people want to know what how your personal experiences shaped your views on things like leadership, on education, and advocacy, which you do right now.
Yeah, I think, the catalyst for me was stories. I love listening to stories because my dad was a storyteller. So he would tell me stories about South Sudan. He would tell me stories about peace. You know, tell me one day you'll get to go back home. And when I got to Kakuma refugee camp, the camp is very diverse. There are about 280,000 refugees from more than 10 different countries, mostly from South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and of course Somalia. And I just love going around my high school, talking to kids, hearing their stories, how they get to the refugee camp, what are their dreams, what are their hope. And I saw that, in the school we have very limited resources. There was no really space for kids to come together to play, to be happy, to have access to mentorship opportunities. So that is when I created my first initiative, the Refugee Youth Peace Ambassadors. We used to be a youth group that would bring together young people and run mentorship program, run leadership workshop, game and sport activities, community dialogue and campaign, just trying to create a space for young people to have peer support, but also to be happy together, to play together, to dream together, and to look toward a brighter future.
Right. Now, your initiatives in Kakuma have empowered thousands of young people, says over here, over 20,000 young people. What strategies did you use to achieve such a significant impact?
Yeah, I think one of the key strategies we use is community-led effort. So I firmly believe that for you to be able to make a difference in the community, you have to involve that community, which is something that don't happen a lot in a lot of change-making work. Oftentimes, you will see, for example, very big international organization coming to refugee camps and other marginalized communities and saying, oh, this is what project we thought would help you. But what we did with the Refugee Peace Ambassadors was like, we would go to communities and see what are the challenges and try to design those programs together with them. So the game and sport activities that would create, for example, were designed together with young people. You know, what sport do they want to play? How do they want to do it? The leadership workshops that we used to run, we co-create them together with young people. The mentorship sessions, we used to have this one session every Wednesday where we would today talk about someone who is inspirational or someone who inspired them, mostly former refugees. You know, we have talked about people like Ilhan Omar, people like Emmanuel Jal, people who have been through displacement, people like Alima Aden, and they always
and
look
made
up to
it.
And made it, right? Yeah. So it was like a session that they would say and say, oh, this is the person we want to talk about today. So I think one of the strategies we use that sort of community co-creation and community ownership, so the community felt like this is something they own. Mm. And the model was like, if you organize a session, every single person that come to that session then become a peace ambassador.
Yeah.
So you go back to your community and try to organize other sessions, so you actually turn into a big network of young people who are all passionate about leadership and community engagement.
Right. And you say that storytelling is really the cornerstone of your
exactly
advocacy efforts.
Yeah.
How do you craft stories that inspire policy and systemic changes?
I think stories are very, very powerful, because oftentimes I feel like, you know, when you look at how policies are being promulgated around the world, you know, I've been to so many conferences where I hear very high-level government officials or UN leaders talking about the refugee camps. You know, they'll talk about Kakuma, or they'll talk about Kigeme in Rwanda, or they'll talk about, you know, Dzaleka in Malawi. And I've been to all those refugee camps. I'm like, I don't think that's the place I grew up in. You know, I don't think that's the place I've been to. I don't think that is how someone from the refugee camp would describe it. So I think stories help humanize the refugee experience, right? It helps people sort of, you know, see refugees not just as numbers on their TV screen or, you know, on their phone screen, but they see them as people with unique experiences, you know, with unique hope, with unique dream. So being able to do that and share authentic stories of people, you know, both the good, the bad, the ugly, but also the inspiration in it as well, because refugees' stories are not just about, you know, the devastation and the hopelessness. You know, there's so much courage, there's so much creativity. So trying to bring all those together and saying that, you know, refugees are more than just, you know, numbers. They are people with dreams and hopes. And I think that really, you know, contribute toward formulating policies that are effective in changing people's lives.
Right. Tell us more about the Kakuma Leadership and Innovation Center. Well, what is your vision for this project, and what challenges are you currently facing?
Yeah, so the Kakuma Leadership and Innovation Center, you know, will be a center that will really work toward, you know, creating a powerful space for young people in the refugee camp to come together, to connect, to learn, to heal, and to innovate for a better future together. So the center will have a library that will be equipped with about 10,000 books, mostly post-secondary books. It will have an innovation hub with high-speed internet connectivity and computers. It will have a training hall, of course, where we'll do our training programs. It will have our offices where both she leads Kakuma and the refugee peace ambassadors will be hosted. And it's going to just be a community center where young people will come, be able to learn, be able to connect with the world outside, and also create an opportunity for the world to connect with Kakuma. And hopefully, you know, I really hope that the center will be a space that will open pathway for young people in the refugee camp to be able to access learning opportunities, but also to access job opportunities. Actually, my first job was for a British company that I work for in Kakuma Refugee Camp, which hired me as a social media person. So I think, you know, that center really, you know, aim toward doing that, creating a pathway for young people in the refugee camp, you know, to get access to opportunities that will allow them to transform their life. And of course, right now, you know, we're in the pace of trying to bring on board partners, trying to bring on board donors, trying to bring on board, you know, people that we can work with to realize the vision. That is the most challenging part of it. But we're almost getting there. So we're in the final stages of, you know, actually being able to start the construction in the refugee camp.
Now, aid localization is one of the cornerstones of your advocacy pillars. Yeah. What steps do you think global institutions that you've worked with, you're currently right now working with the UN as an intern, I believe.
Yeah.
You've engaged with a lot of these institutions, international, global institutions. What do you think they need? What steps do you think global institutions need to take to achieve this idea of aid localization?
Yeah, definitely. I think aid localization is key. Always remind people that every single time there's a crisis anywhere in the world, even with what happened in California, for example, the people that always try to respond first and were always the first responded are the people from within that community. If there's a conflict in South Sudan, it's always the South Sudanese in that community that will try to find a solution first, either, you know, trying to build peace or coming up with peace building solutions, you know, coming up with development solutions. So I really believe that aid should not just be a way of external actors coming into a community and saying, oh, we see your problem, we are here to help you. But instead of trying to become allies, so coming into a community and seeing, what are you doing about these challenges? You know, what solutions are already in place? What community efforts are already in place? And trying to support those efforts. So my vision for aid localization is that we'll live in a world where a big international organization will be able to transfer power, will be able to transfer, you know, funding, will be able to transfer, you know, leadership to small and local organizations that are led by the people and the communities where the issue is. Because, of course, the people that are affected the most are oftentimes the most effective solution makers to the issue affecting them.
What advice would you give for young change makers like yourself who aspire to advocate for their communities on a global stage, on a global scale?
Yeah, I always tell people the first thing, you know, is being very much grounded in your community. You know, change do not happen at the UN headquarters in New York. It happened in Kakuma Refugee Camp. It happened in a small village in Rwanda. It happened in a small village in DRC. So really, you know, try to be very much integrated into your community, you know. Try to talk to people. What are the issues you're seeing? You know, try to hear their stories and then try to design solutions together with them, right? I think when you start at that level, you become an expert about your community. And then now that give you the credibility to come to big international platform and say, these are the issues my community is facing. And this is what they are saying. No, this is what I'm saying, right? I always tell people that I'm just one person. My story is not reflective of all the refugee stories, right? It's just one individual. But hopefully my story, you know, other refugees might relate to my story, right? But it's not the whole picture. So that is one thing I always advise people as well, that you just, you know, not a voice for the voiceless. Everyone in your community have a voice. So how can you use their stories and try to bring them to a global platform?
To amplify them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And to amplify their stories.
So what are some of the key lessons you've learned while engaging with some of these institutions like the UN, the UK House of Lords, the Canadian Parliament, all these big institutions that are global in nature that you've been engaging with over these few years that you've worked in your advocacy?
Yeah, I think one of the key things I've observed, of course, is that I feel like there's a very disconnect between these institutions and the communities on the ground, right? Oftentimes, as I mentioned earlier, you know, when I go to these institutions and they talk about refugees, they talk about displacement, they talk about conflict, they talk about governance, there's so much disconnect between what they're discussing in the, you know, in all these big global institutions and what is actually happening on the ground, right? Of sometime I'd get into the room, I'm the only refugee in the room. I'm the only person who have lived in the refugee camp before, and they're talking about refugees. I think really need to change how these institutions operate, where we need to see more people
who have been affected.
So I think there's that big disconnect. And I think, you know, by bringing in more people who have been affected, you know, they can really, you know, play a key role in sort of making sure that the solutions that are designed by these institutions are effective and, you know, can, you know, have the maximum impact.
What or who inspires you to keep pushing forward in your advocacy work?
I think my dad does a lot. He's you know, someone I talk to all the time. And, you know, growing up, he used to have a small radio and he would listen to the news. And I remember telling him when I was around 8 years old, Dad, how can I broadcast news on your radio? And he told me, you know, go to school, learn good American English, good that you can work for BBC.
I love it.
That's all I wanted to do, RBOA. That's all I wanted to do, and every single time.
And now here we are on the Voice of America,
exactly, the
global network. I guess the dream is coming alive.
The dream is coming alive. Yeah. So every single time I talk to him, he's like, "You see, you were here yesterday. You were on, you know, BOA yesterday. You were on this media the other day. So you are achieving your dreams, and inspire me a lot."
I love that. I love to hear that. Well, what would you say are some of your long-term goals for some of the work that you're doing? In terms of advocacy, leadership, and community development?
I think my long-term goal, honestly, you know, seeing more young people becoming leaders in their communities. I think over the last few years, I've had an opportunity to interact with young people all around the world, and the work they're doing is just incredible. You know, they can become great leaders, they can become great president, you know. So I really hope, you know, that in the future, you know, young people will be able to take that lead in being able to build a very true world for all. You know, and in terms of international development, you know, I really hope that in the future, you know, people will be able to make decisions about their life. You know, refugees in Kakuma will be able to make decisions about what projects they want to see, what issues they want to see prioritized. And that, you know, should be the same thing for every single people that are, you know, living in underserved communities, that they should make decisions about issues that affect them.
That was Nyal Deng, a South Sudanese refugee activist and youth advocate. He joined me here at the Voice of America. Let's take a quick break and listen to some of your responses to our question of the week.
Well, let me say that I believe personally that leadership is something that one is born with. So, yes, I would say that we can learn to be a leader in class, but at the same time, I would say that you don't necessarily need to sit in a classroom.
We are not supposed to be taught on how to be a good leader, but we are supposed to learn, okay? If someone wants to be a good leader, he or she is supposed to learn maybe from other people, from other leaders, from their role models.
Many thanks to all of you for sending in your opinions. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Studies show that Africa's space sector is steadily expanding, with over 20 countries establishing national space initiatives and plans to launch more than 100 additional satellites in the sky by 2025. But even with this kind of developments, many believe that Africa is still lagging behind in the space race and should do more to catch up with their developed counterparts. Ethiopian-American space scientist Dr. Brooke Lacue is the Associate Director for Planning and R&D at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. This is considered the largest Earth and space science research organization in the world. He tells me that even though space exploration requires a lot of resources, it is necessary if African governments are to become less reliant on foreign technology and to take control of their own environmental and national security. Dr. Brooke Lacue, thank you so much for joining us today. How does one become a space scientist? Where did you start? Tell us a little bit about your story.
My story is a little different because when I talk to my colleagues and their path to space science, it's kind of straight line. You know, they went to high school, they knew what they were going to be doing. Then they went to college and did PhD in astronomy, astrophysics, or astrochemistry, and so on and so forth. Yeah. In my case, I was born in Ethiopia. I went to a French school, local. My tuition was 5 Ethiopian birr. Can you imagine? It's a few cents per month. You know? Now it's a lot of money.
But, skyrocketed.
Skyrocketed. Mm. And so when I finished high school there, the French government gave me a scholarship to go and study in France. And so I went there and I did physics and chemistry, double major in college. And then I did physical chemistry in my PhD.
For your master's and PhD?
Yes, University of Paris.
Yeah.
And at the time, the Ethiopian government was a military dictatorship. My parents, everybody said, don't come back. So like everybody else, I migrated to the United States. Mm-hmm. And during my thesis work, doing my PhD, I studied the surface physics of solids. And in space, the way you create a signal from a spacecraft or whatever you're looking at is by getting radiation from it and then having a sensor that converts that radiation power, radiating power into electricity.
Mm.
And that's a surface property. And that's how I my training converged with what NASA needs.
I see. So it came at the time when I guess science had evolved to that level of understanding of this very specific thing.
Yes, exactly. Specifically a mission called the Cosmic Background Explorer. And it was launched in 1989, and it was looking for the very early stage of the universe, the Big Bang. And the lead scientist got a Nobel Prize in 2006 for the work of that mission.
Yes, I think I remember
and
that.
So then, I got involved in that, and because it was looking at the very early universe, the very cold, way back, the Big Bang.
The Big Bang theory.
Yes. So it avoided looking at the sun, because the sun is very hot, and you're looking, you have extremely sensitive sensors on board. So the spacecraft, instead of being an equatorial orbit around the Earth, it was polar and looking away from the sun. And when it does that, at the north and south, the Earth's magnetic field traps a lot of radiation from the sun, protons, electrons, that bombarded the spacecraft. And the request that I had, the assignment that I was given, is to study what that radiation does to the sensors of the spacecraft. Mm. So
was it disrupting the sensors?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So you came up with a solution.
Yes, exactly. So
you joined NASA around what, 1999?
No, much earlier, 1984.
84. Oh wow, that's much earlier.
At the time, I was not a federal scientist employee. I was employed through a contract.
Okay.
But
still working with NASA.
Absolutely. Okay. The whole time.
Okay. And so you saw the space technology evolving from 1984. Really. Is quite at the early stages of it.
Some of our instruments, like the second mission I was involved in that sent a spacecraft to Saturn, the instrument was 42 kilograms. Now nobody would send that heavy an instrument.
Yes, it's too heavy.
And because of the advent of miniaturization, all the sensors and the electronics, the optics, everything is very, very small.
I'm glad that you brought that up. I've heard that the early space explorers, I guess the guys who went to the moon, mm-hmm. the first people, they use the technology they use is the same technology that we use in our phones.
No, this is that the phone is much more powerful
right now.
The processor, the memory, yeah. a lot of stuff they were actually doing manually. Computing the angle from the star that they used as a reference.
Yeah.
It was an extremely high-risk mission.
It
worked, but now it's automatically done for you through computers.
Well, things have changed a lot.
And so one of the contributions of NASA is that it requires all the time miniaturizing everything, making it smaller and smaller, and industry followed. And so in the end, you have these kinds of things that are...
That being used in consumer products
exactly,
like
benefiting humanity
right.
in many ways.
What kind of data have we collected so far in our research that gives us a better understanding of our own planet here on Earth?
Okay, so there are four major science areas of research in space. One of them is Earth science, studying our own Earth. Our Earth is constantly changing. You know, life that changes even the surface of it. We've lost the history of how the Earth evolved to come to it now because of constant change. Rain, forests, fire, all kinds of things. Water, life makes it that it's very difficult to find the past. Whereas, and so we need to monitor what's going on, including the climate change that we're bringing now. Mm-hmm. It's evident now that it's happening. So that's Earth science. The other one is astrophysics, looking at the universe as a whole, all the big galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, the enormous width of the universe as it is now, and it's expanding significantly every second.
Every second, we're discovering new things.
No, the galaxies are going away from each other at very high velocity.
Okay.
You know, thousands of miles per second.
Moving away from each other.
And so the big question is whether it's going to come back because of gravity will pull it back, or will it expand forever and cool down and kind of die, you know? That's one big question of astrophysics. The other field is the... exploring our own solar system. It's called planetary science, and that's where I've been for the last 30 years, looking at Mars, the Moon, the outer planets, and looking for life elsewhere. It's a big issue. And then the other one is the Sun-Earth connection, you know, heliophysics, you know. How is the Earth and Sun, how are they interacting?
That relationship between the Sun,
You know, whenever there's a huge burst on the Sun, it has a huge flare, it has an impact on our, you know, power grid and stuff like that. So that's the study. And so there's a lot of data captured from all these satellites that are in space, looking at all the different Earth or the planets or the universe or the Sun-Earth connection.
Okay.
And so there's data.
And we're able to learn, to synthesize that and learn something about ourselves.
So there's a lot of scientists at NASA and also in academia, in the universities, who are looking at this data. It's available to everyone. The public paid for it. So after a mission is sent and it gets the data, what we do is calibrate it, make sure that the data is reliable, and then make it available to the science.
To public research institutions.
Exactly.
That will...
And even, you know, worldwide.
Okay.
The African scientists will also have access.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the future. What does the future of space exploration look like? We've seen many people attempting to go to Mars, to other planets. Are we looking at colonies on any of these planets
right.
at least in our lifetime?
In our lifetime, what we will probably see is a colony on the moon. The four astronauts that are going to be going to the moon in the next year or so just got selected last March. One African-American, one woman, and two other astronauts, one from Canada, were selected. So what they're going to do is go to the moon, orbit around the moon, and come back without actually landing, just to make sure that the whole system works well. And then the next phase is going to be astronauts going to land on the moon. and specifically not near the equator where the previous landers did, go to the south pole of the moon, because the south pole has a lot of very deep craters that are completely dark all the time, and it looks like there's water ice there. If there is a water ice, then we can stay there for a much longer time and have a moon base. And then the idea is potentially to go to Mars from the moon, because the moon is much, much smaller in size, a quarter the size of the Earth, so it's much easier to take off from the moon. Of course, there are some issues with dust on the moon. As I was telling earlier, on Earth, a lot of things are weathered. On the moon, it's not weathering. So a lot of these, it's called regolith. Dust, it sticks to you because the sun sends all these protons, electrons that charge them, and it's difficult. So gravity-wise, is much easier to go from the moon to Mars.
But other elements,
there's other issues. So in the very near future, it's landing on the moon and having a base there where we learn to live outside Earth for a long time. And it's kind of a training ground to go to Mars.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. We're still speaking to Ethiopian-American space scientist Dr. Brooke Lacue.
Now, a question that many people ask, I think is part of a wider debate of the U.S. and other developing countries spend billions of dollars for space exploration. And they're asking, is there justification to spend that much resources to go to the moon and other places in space when there's a lot of suffering? There's so much need for the resources here on Earth. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I've thought about this issue. Africa needs to be in space. There's no choice in my view. Being behind in that area costs African nations quite a lot. For instance, for communication, for telephone, for education, remote education to their provinces and stuff. They pay hundreds of millions of dollars rent to get the bandwidth from private satellites and so on and so forth. Even, you know, if you look at that, it'd be enormous saving if they had their own communication satellite. And also now, with the miniaturization that I mentioned, you have CubeSats. They're like 10-centimeter cube. And that's one unit. You can have a 6U where you can have quite a few things and that you can launch.
Is that what we hear when we, for example, like Uganda sent a satellite to space recently and Kenya?
Kenya did one.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, what's different about the Kenyan satellite, it was built by engineers from a private company in Kenya. That's a departure from
private sector investment in space in Africa is happening.
And was launched by SpaceX.
Yeah.
And so that's very early stage, but it should be encouraged. I think Africa is wasting quite a bit of resources through internal wars and stuff. You know, I'm not saying it's only in Africa, because wars happen around the world, as we know now. But leaders should make every effort possible to avoid these things and focus on what's important for the future. Being present in space is controlling your own financial transactions, controlling how you grow crops from space. You can map, you can see where moisture is low or high and so on and so forth. It's even important for national security. So it's not a choice. You have to be there. And to do so, I think, regional cooperations,
bodies,
like Kenya has on San Marco Island, a launch pad that Italians use. It's near the equator. As you know, when you launch from the equator, you get the Earth rotates faster at the equator, so you get all that velocity attached to it. And so, you know, the launch could be in Kenya. The satellite could be assembled in Uganda. Some of the electronics could be done in Ethiopia, and so on.
And research happens some other places.
It's safe. Yes, absolutely. It's not prohibitively difficult.
That was Dr. Brooke Lacue. Dr. Lacue is the Associate Director for Planning and R&D
Solar System Exploration Division at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He joined me in studio here. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests and to you for tuning in. Until next time, my name is Jackson Bunga.